Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for TWiT specials is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT Live special number 316, recorded January 5th, 2017. CES 2017. This TWiT Live special is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decisions of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interest in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/twit. It's loud. There's a lot of energy, and I'm on top of an RV with a jacuzzi and a helicopter. It must be CES 2017. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit from the Elysium at the Furion booth, and here's the best of CES. If there's one universal need in this digital age, it's storage. We want storage. We want a lot of storage. We want fast storage, which is why we've stopped here at Synology in the South Hall. I'm speaking with Patrick, who's going to explain what Synology is doing to make your storage not just storage. Now, Patrick, that's sort of a cryptic way of saying Synology has really grown past what you used to be. Just maybe 5 years ago, you were a storage company. You made great storage network-attached products, but you've been growing past that. Tell me a little bit about what's been happening with Synology over the last year or so.
Well, I think what you're starting to see is that the term NAS, which we've used in the past, it's getting difficult to even apply that to our products, where in the past it meant network-attached storage. Now, that industry, it could include everything going from kind of some small time capsule all the way up to what we're doing, and we provide a lot of different applications, so you can watch videos on all of your TVs, you could set up a mail server at home, a DNS server. So what we're finding these days is, actually the term NAS, maybe we need to redefine it to something like networking applications and storage.
And I think Synology really does lead the field in this, because as you mentioned, there's been a lot of boxes out there that do NAS, network attached storage. Yeah. But then they have a little extra horsepower, so maybe you would run an email client on it, or maybe you would run a media server.
Yeah.
With Synology's products, especially some of the newer ones, there's so much extra horsepower, and there's so much flexibility built into the plug-in system that the storage is almost a second thought. It's my NAS box at home. It's actually my container. It allows me to run all my containers, so I can run a browser in a container. It allows me to run my DNS server. It allows me to run my storage server. Yep. It allows me to run my VPN.
Yep.
And it's sort of like I'm buying that, and then I'm getting a NAS in addition to that.
Yeah. Oh, no, totally. I mean, actually, you just said everything that I could possibly say about it. These days, when you look at our NAS application ecosystem, we have over 100 applications that you can easily download and install. Most of them come for free. Some of the really interesting things that we've been playing around with recently is the idea of collaboration. People, the way they work these days is they want to collaborate in real time. They want to work on a document or a spreadsheet, and I don't want to have to close it and then email it to you, and then you open it and you make your changes and then you email it back to me. So what we're doing is we've actually made some applications called Office and Chat. And what that does is it gives you, allows you to actually run your own private cloud productivity applications, where you and I could be writing a document at the same time in the browser, and all of it is happening on your Synology device. So it doesn't have to be stored on some mysterious third-party server wherever you don't know where it is.
The members of our TWiT army are very, very familiar with this. In fact, there's people who watch Know How and Security Now with Leo Laporte and Steve Gibson who are saying, wait a minute, I can host my own web services. So I can use my own box for email, my own box for chat, and it can be all encrypted, and I'm the only one who holds the keys. That's, I think, one of the things that Synology really enables. Now, let's talk a little bit about that collaboration, because I want to talk about something that last year blew me away, and that was Synology's release of their first ever router, the 1900 AC.
Oh, yeah.
Fantastic product. We've recommended it to our audience. I run one at home. It's probably the best router I've ever had, and I use it for more than just routing. Again, it's got my VPN. It's got a media server. It's got a DNS server. You've updated it. Yep. Tell me about this one, because this is a monster. It's beautiful, and I want to know what it can do.
Well, this is our new router, as you mentioned. It's called the RT2600AC. It should be released in the U.S. Later this month. As you can probably tell, if you're a router aficionado from the name, it's a 2600-class router. That means that when you have both of the bands running, you could get up to 2.5 gigabits of simultaneous connectivity. And it comes with all like the newest Wave 2, 4x4 MU-MIMO, all the specs that you want from a router in this class. But I mean, as you've been mentioning, the really special thing about Synology is our software. And I don't know, I remember going to my sister's house one time, and she asked me to look into the router, and I logged in there, and it's some 20-year-old web page that hasn't been updated forever, and I can't imagine, she's like a nurse, you know? I can't imagine how she's going to do this. So we've taken our expertise from making a user-friendly operating system for our NAS, and we've applied that same experience to the router, our router over here, just in order to provide a really easy, intuitive user experience for anybody who might not really know about networking or how to log into a router backend.
And that was one of the things that impressed us about the RT1900 and now the new 2600, which is, it's a router that an expert will love, because I can do things like I can find out exactly how much every device is using on my network, or how much every service is using on my network. I can do per user lockout, but also this device will update itself. I can set it up for my parents and say, don't ever touch it. It will take care of itself. But I got to ask, this is kind of a pricey device. I mean, we're talking about $300 for this, which is where the other router started. Why would I buy that? If I was an end user, if I was a typical consumer, how would you sell me on buying what, to me, sounds like it's too high end of a device? It's something that's way overkill.
Okay. Well, first of all, the pricing in the U.S. hasn't been officially announced yet, but it should be more something like $220. Well, which I believe is actually pretty reasonable when it comes to a 2600 class router. Now, the thing that you mentioned a little bit ago is the fact that you can run your VPN server on this. You can run DNS server. You can actually use our application called Cloud Station. So this could become your file syncing hub, so that you could sync files from your computer to your phone, back to the router, and you can access them from anywhere. And then when it comes to managing the network, well, this comes with application layer QoS. Have you heard of that before? And what that does is, with old traditional routers, if you wanted to limit, if I wanted to limit your bandwidth, the only thing I could do would be to select your device and say, this device can only use so much bandwidth. But with layer 7, actually, I can go a step further, and I can say, when this device is using something like this music playing app, restrict the bandwidth. But let him use all the bandwidth he wants to when he's using other applications. Now, a couple years ago, if you wanted a feature like this, you would have had to buy some really expensive, dedicated, professional-level hardware. So for that, I'd say this is a pretty good deal. And actually, that's, you know, something that we really tried to do at Synology is bring these professional-level applications down to the ordinary enthusiast user space. Yeah.
Patrick, thank you very much for speaking with us. Now, if they wanted to find out more about Synology's products, everything from your NASs that are more than NASs to your routers, where can they go?
Oh, well, they could go to our website, www.synology.com, or they could also follow us on Facebook or Twitter.
Thanks again for your time. Synology, it's not just storage anymore. Before we go on, I do want to point something out that I think is important for the audience to understand, and that is CES is a crazy place. I mean, this is a celebration of geek culture, and sometimes you got to go over the top. That's what the guys at Furion have done with this. This is the Elysium. We're actually standing on the top deck of an RV in the middle of their booth. Now, this is not just any regular RV. Down below, they've got all their appliances, and up top, we've got a jacuzzi, and yes, folks, that actually is a helicopter. Now, behind me, they've got a prosthesis that, do you remember the movie Aliens when Ripley is fighting the Big Bag Mama? Well, that's essentially what it is. You get in the middle of that, and as you move your arms and your feet, it moves the limbs of the robot, of the prosthesis. All of this, of course, is part of the showmanship, the salesmanship of CES. But this is one of the things that we love. Yes, some of this might be over the top. Yes, some of this might be beyond the reach of most of us. But it shows us what's possible when someone with an idea and a little bit of money and a lot of tech gets their hands on some cool stuff. We're going to show you more and more of this across the show floor of CES. But for me, it doesn't get better than the Elysium. Hey, Brian, bring me more wine. We've seen robotics at CES in the past, but usually they're surrounded by some sort of safety cage because robots can't work with humans. Well, that all changes here at Bosch. I'm speaking with Franz, and Franz, what is your position at Bosch?
I'm director in Bosch, responsible for the collaborative robotic and for the IT shop floor solution, for our software solutions. And what I can show you here today is what we see here, collaborative robotic. What does it mean? Humans and robots work close together. What we have done for that is we developed an electronical sensor skin, and because of the sensor skin, the robot stops before touching the human. And that's the reason why it's allowed that the human and the robot can work together. What you see here is an APAS workstation. The human can do an identification on the table, then the table goes to the right position. The work introductions you can see here change to the right language for the worker. And then the general idea is that the human and the robot work together. The robot supports the human. He does the stupid pick and place. And the human do the complex stuff, easy to do in automation for if you have low volumes. And that's the point.
This is amazing because every time I've seen an industrial robot, there's always been a lot of caution because these are powerful machines that could do a lot of damage to the human body. Yeah. The fact that you've put the design work into making sure that that can't happen, it's almost like the start of Asimov's law of robotics. This robot can do no harm. In fact, can you show us what happens if a human gets too close to the operating robot?
You see here, I'm not close enough. You see 5 centimeters before he touched me, he stops. And then if I go away, you see he will restart. And then if I come close to him, he stops.
Oh, what about the little attachment at the bottom? I mean, could you get your finger stuck in there? Could it do some damage?
It's also safe. There is no force who can hurt your hand. It's also tested. We do this, and we have grippers who snapped inside if it touched the human.
This is very different. I mean, this is the start of Iron Man's the workshop, where he has robots who actually help him with his tasks.
Correct.
Where can you bring this technology? I mean, right now it's set up for an industrial setting, but does Bosch see this as something that will eventually end up in homes and small businesses?
Yeah, we currently searching for each kind of business where the robot can support the humans, each kind of jobs you can imagine. And we have a lot of other ideas where we can do that, for example, in the food area and so on, where the robot can do some stuff and so on. A lot of different areas and business fields we want to go with this robot technology in the future.
Franz, thank you very much for speaking with us. Thank you for sharing this technology. If they wanted to find out more about Bosch, if they wanted to find out more about your robots, more about perhaps what this new assistive technology can do, where should they go?
To our Bosch APAS homepage.
Thank you very much. And I, for one, welcome our robotic overlords. The Internet of Things has been, well, an area of concern for a lot of us in security because so much of it has been based on a very insecure foundation. Well, if you want to do the IoT right, why not start with a security company? That's why I'm speaking with Rob Moore from ADT. Last year, we took a look at Pulse. It's their foray into this sort of ADT everywhere, a smart home, a smart device, and even into the cloud. Rob, what has ADT done with Pulse since then?
Well, we're happy to be here. So Pulse, this year, we're really excited about the ability to expand our ecosystem. We started a few years ago with Nest, we added Ring, and this year we've added Amazon Echo. So now I can control my control my system with my voice. Think about that mom walking into the house with the groceries full in her arms, right? And the timer's beeping on the countdown. Now, instead of having to race to set that down and get back to disarm your system, now you can do it with your voice. So we're excited to be the first ones to do that with Amazon.
Okay, wait a minute.
mind. I have seen a security system that I can arm with my voice, but I remember it didn't allow me to disarm because, well, that's kind of insecure. You have to make sure that your service actually knows it's your voice and what exactly you're commanding it to do before it will do that. How does ATT do that with confidence? You're using Alexa, you're using Amazon's API. What have you done to make sure that if I'm disarming it, it's really me that's disarming it?
So what we did is we worked with Amazon to ensure the security. They wanted it on as well as we did. So what we have to do when you want to disarm your system or you want to unlock the front door or open the garage, we require a PIN code. So you can say, Alexa, ask ADT to disarm the system with PIN 1234. And it allows you to then securely disarm your system, unlock a door, or open the garage.
And one of the things that I enjoy is that you are a security company. I mean, you're not network security, but physical security. So you do take this seriously. You've been playing with this product for more than a year now, and it sounds like it's become pretty successful to the point that you're now branching out. Last year, you mentioned this idea of security as a service. As we move down to this part of the table, I see that security as a service has moved from a demonstration to something that you can actually buy.
We're very excited about it. So last year we talked about our partnership with LG and the LG Smart Security device. What we've done now is we've brought that device to the market. Now it's available on Amazon.com. You can go ahead and buy it. And now it's monitoring the way you want monitoring. It's a no-contract, month-to-month solution. So you can bring that to the table and say, look, I'm going on vacation for a few months. I want ADT to protect my home for those 2 months. And then the other 2 months or the other 10 months of the year, do what you want. Right? So it's monitoring your way.
But it's not just monitoring, it's also coming with you. I see back here that you've got a Samsung Gear S3, and it's got an interesting watch face with a panic button. What exactly is that?
So as part of the ADT Canopy solution, we've been able to now go from a professionally home monitor now to security on the go. So with my S3, I can take this and I can hit that panic button, and now our monitoring centers know exactly where I am, and they're sending GPS information. We're going to treat you the same way we do as a customer that has ADT in your home. We're going to call your contact list, and then we're going to reach out to the authorities wherever you may be. If you're out mountain biking and you crash and you need help, we're going to dispatch authorities. If you're walking through your home and you fall or you need help, we're going to get to the help that you need.
Of course, it's not just on smart watches. You really want ADT to be everywhere, including just your smartphone, Android or iOS.
That's correct. So we now have ADT Anywhere. And ADT Anywhere will allow us to, in our partnership with Life360, to add the ADT Panic solution. So now if I'm out on the go and I'm feeling insecure, I can tap that ADT Panic button and it's going to give me the countdown. It's going to say, hey, we're going to alert the authorities. We're going to start that same process, whether you had it on the watch or you had it in your home. And now you have that protection on the go and with your family. We'll also send you alerts of sex offenders in the area. We're also going to know about driving and how you're driving and whether your daughter is driving a little faster than she might be driving or should be driving. So we're excited about that partnership.
Okay, Rob, I got to ask this because our audience is incredibly savvy. They know their technology. And some of us, like myself, are always excited whenever a vendor tries to integrate the Internet of Things and things like the Amazon Alexa API. That sort of integration gives us something that we didn't have before, and that's just always a good thing. But there's the other side of me. There's the networking guy. There's the security guy who's thinking, you know, when I think of Internet of Things, when I think of connected devices, I also think of that's a way for my stuff, my data, to be compromised. What is ADT doing to make sure that all this connectedness isn't somehow going to, well, compromise my digital life?
That's a great question, something that we're always concerned about. We're confident in the security that we provide on your home and your property, wherever you may be now with ADT Anywhere and ADT Canopy. The security is a concern. We're always working with our product security team to ensure that the partners that we bring to the table bring the highest level of security. So whether it's the Samsung S3, whether it's Amazon, whether it's LG, we're going to make sure that they bring that high level of security that we bring to our customers as well.
So basically, bring in the partners who know how to do it. And that way, the solution stays secure.
We feel confident in those partnerships. And that's why it's a manicured ecosystem of partnerships and not just open to the wild, wild west.
Rob, thank you very much. Good luck to you and good luck to ADT. If they wanted to find out more about ADT solutions, about ADT security, where can they go?
So we have a website specifically for CES. You can go to ces.adt.com. It has all the information about what we talked about today and links into adt.com as well.
If you're looking for security in your home, in your car, wherever you are, think ADT. If you're a fan of computers, you know that Samsung is often associated with high performance. Everything from their SSDs to their beautiful screens. Well, now they want to be known as a gaming company. That's right. I'm standing in front of the Odyssey. This is their 17-inch model, and it is a thing of beauty. We've got a full HD screen, and yes, I've got my full-size keyboard that can be individually illuminated for the games that I want to play. In other words, I only light up the keys that I'm using in that particular game. But it's not just the fast performance. It's not just the i7 Kaby Lakes processor. It's not just the fact that this is an entire package that's going to give you four USB 3 ports, a Thunderbolt port, and an Ethernet port. It's the fact that they've built this thing to be upgradable. You flip this over, and with three screws, I get access to two, not one, but two M.2 bays, so I can upgrade my SSDs, and I get four slots for memory. What this means is that I'm not going to be stuck with the configuration that I purchased. As my needs progress, as my gaming gets more intense, as I need to eke out every bit of performance that I can possibly get, I just upgrade and I'm good to go. Now, this base model is going to come with a 1070 NVIDIA processor, so it's going to have plenty of power when you need to do, well, Overwatch. We're going to see more and more of this, the 17-inch version and the 15-inch version coming from Samsung probably in the next quarter or two. And if you're looking for gaming and you want to get it from the source, maybe you need to go on an Odyssey. Of course, one of the big stories of CES has to be the rise of the self-driving or the assisted car. We can't talk about that without coming to Ford. That's why I'm speaking with James, who was, I'd say, the father of the autonomous assisted driving program at Ford. Sir, what has Ford brought to CES?
Well, what you're looking at behind you is our latest research vehicle. And on this vehicle, we've moved to sensors that are a little more production intent. And essentially, you know, we have to get out and do a lot of validation and testing to make sure our algorithms are, you know, robust and safe and reliable everywhere. And you're looking at the latest test vehicle in that fleet.
I'm glad you brought that up, because coming from Silicon Valley, my company is immersed in an area where companies think that they can put out five or six alphas, a couple of betas, and just sort of work out the kinks as we go. The VC who have invested in this technology have realized that's not really the case when it comes to car. It kind of has to be perfect when it comes out. So what has Ford brought to this, you know, undoubtedly new field from the traditional automaking pedigree?
Well, you know, I'd like to point out that we started in 2004, literally right here in Las Vegas in an event called the DARPA Grand Challenges. So I've got 12 years working on this, and, you know, we have a lot of experience in algorithm development. And additionally, you know, we've built cars for 100 years, so we know how to build a platform that's, you know, reliable and robust. And, you know, a lot of testing and validation goes into everything we do, because safety is our number one concern.
All right, let's talk about safety, because if we look at this modified Fusion, there are a few things that stand out. First of all, you've got a rack of cameras around the top, and then you've got two LiDAR systems. How many sensors do you really need? What's the bare minimum to make a safe self-driving vehicle?
So if you're out on the roadway and I say to you, you know, feel free to check out of the driving experience, I have to be able to handle everything you can handle and then some. And you know, when you're looking at traffic scenarios, things can come from anywhere around the vehicle. You could have a merge ramp back over your, you know, shoulder. You could have cars intersecting at an angle. So effectively, you really do need to see 360 degrees around the car. You need complete situational awareness. And no one sensor is without some deficiency. So we have multi-mode sensor modalities on this car. We use, you know, traditional radar systems. We use cameras that you're referring to on the roof. We use LiDAR. We leverage any prior information we have about the world around us. In particular, we make 3D maps of everything we drive through. So when we come back, we know what it should look like. And if it doesn't, you know, that prompts us to be a little bit, you know, more alert to what's going on. So you need that sort of fidelity of lots of systems, lots of extra information to make really smart decisions.
Now, if I'm not sure if the audience can see it, but right above us are actually screens that show what the vehicle is seeing in real time. Tell me, what's the magic? What's the process of turning that, what the car can see, into how it should act? Because, you know, this is the part that's always puzzled me about self-driving cars. I can't think of every scenario a vehicle might be in at any given time. And yet, I might have to program for that. I might have to account for a motorcycle that's out of spec and a little bit too low, or account for a car that can't quite be seen by the regular cameras. So, you know, as a project manager, what are the problems that keep you up at night that you think we need to solve this, we need to tackle this before we let this off into the road?
Well, you've asked me like about five really great questions, and I'd like to answer them all. So let's start with the scenarios. If I asked you what's the weirdest thing that ever happened in your lifetime of driving, I can guarantee you it won't be the same as mine or anyone else's in the audience. And yet we have to be robust to any of those scenarios that anyone could ever encounter. So, you know, we have to get out on the road and, you know, experience all of these potential driving scenarios. Now, you know, that being said, some of them fall into generic categories. And, you know, I'll give you an example that maybe is a weird one that I've seen. I was on the freeway. Prize horses in a trailer in front of me, the bottom rusted out. They fell through the trailer and horse meat got thrown on my car. Now, I don't think many of the software programmers would write, if horse meat, then do this. But generically, it's road debris in the highway. So we would want a system that can generically handle a whole category of things that would be road debris. And so that would be sort of the scenario of a testing matrix, things that we would look at. And we would try to make sure that we encompass all the things that you and I as a human driver in a whole lifetime would see on the road.
What are the things that keep you up at night? When you think of what steps do I need to take before I can go to Ford and say, it's ready, what would be the big bullet point items?
So I would say, again, to the exhaustive testing to make sure that you've covered all the scenarios. In addition to that, we're doing something very ambitious here. You know, we're trying to basically replace the functionality of a human being in a car. And that includes our sensing and our decision making. And, that's quite challenging. And the sensing as part of that is, quite frankly, not something that the supply chain has been asked to do in the past. So we're asking people to make LIDARs and supercomputers that haven't typically been found on cars, and to do it at the same pace that we're developing our algorithms and platform. So, you know, getting those two to merge on the same time scale is going to be a challenge.
All right, now I've got to ask the big question, because everyone out there wants to know, when do I get my self-driving car? What kind of timeline are we looking at? And realistically, are we looking at this the wrong way? The owner of our network, Leo Laporte, often says that when we look at self-driving technology, what it really should be is it's assistive technology. It helps us be better drivers, it helps us be safer drivers, and it's willing to take control when we do something stupid. So how should we look at this tech, and when is it really going to land into the lap of the average driver?
So let's be clear here. On the car that we're looking at in the background, this one is aimed at what the industry would call level 4 autonomy, which is full autonomy with no human intervention. So I'm not going to necessarily be in that realm where I need your assistance. That's a difficult proposition to drive the car for, you know, tens or hundreds or thousands of miles and then like that say, hey, I give up, it's your turn. It's not a fair proposition. So in that vein, we anticipate, and we've announced previously, that in 21 that we'll release a commercial application of a level 4 self-driving car. And most likely in that time frame, what will be containable will be a fleet service, either ride share or ride hailing or package delivery, something where you have a little bit more control over the vehicles. You get them back every day. You make sure the sensors are calibrated. You make sure they're well maintained. The maps are up to date. Everything's fresh. Things that you can't guarantee when you sell a product to someone who may go away and you never see them again.
James, just one last question. If you were to speak to our audience and talk to, we've got some extreme geeks out there, and tell them what they should be thinking as they consider a self-driving car going into 2021, what would it be? What would be those words of wisdom? What would be that little bit of experience that you want to hand on as to what they should be looking for and what trends they should be tracking?
Well, you know, when I got into this project, we participated in these challenges sponsored by DARPA. And the idea was that we thought if we could make a car that drove itself, we could probably make a car that was safer. And we didn't really realize that we could actually make a car that drove itself until we did it. And so, now that we're at that point in time, a whole host of other things come along with the car just driving itself. You have the potential for mobility for people that are elderly, disabled, young, maybe can't afford a car. We can reduce congestion in the cities, improve fuel economy. You know, a whole number of wonderful applications is opened up once you crack the ability to drive the car. So that's what people should be looking for is, once they get it, it'll have, not only the function of driving itself, but a lot of other things that come with it.
James, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for your experience. And thank you for everything you've done to bring Ford to this point. Folks, if you're looking for the ultimate self-driving car, maybe you should start with a company that actually knows how to make a car. We'll be back to the action in just a bit. But first, let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of this Twit Live special. You know, I remember when I was a kid with my father applying for a loan and having all those big banker's boxes with receipts and pay stubs, going to a banker and trying to convince him to give us a loan. He looked at me and said, you know, one day, son, you'll be a man and you'll get to enjoy all of this. Of course he didn't say that because mortgages are horrible. They're a terrible process that requires you to dig up all your financial information, bring it to a bank, and then get embarrassed by a person who gets to decide whether or not you're a good investment. Folks, that's not how we do it anymore because now we've got Rocket Mortgage. Now, when it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone who you can trust, someone who has your best interest in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you're going to get a transparent, an online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision and get the mortgage that's right for you. You can securely share your financial information to get a mortgage approval in just minutes. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure that you get a mortgage solution that's right for you and not one that's just a cookie cutter template. Here's what we want you to do. We want you to skip the bank. We want you to skip the waiting. We want you to go completely online at quickenloans.com/twit. That's quickenloans.com/twit. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for their support of this Twit Live special. Robotics are one of the more interesting aspects of the Consumer Electronics Show. But what good are robots if they can't help you with the really mundane tasks? Like, for example, dealing with your laundry. That's why we're here at FoldyMate, and I'm going to speak with the founder, the CEO of the company, to ask him what exactly this robot can do for you. Sir, this is, it's a robot that folds your laundry. Tell me, what was the genesis of this idea?
You know, laundry, when you have kids, it never ends, right? Every day, and you can't get enough of it. And it's not enough, we need to do the washing and the drying. Eventually, someone needs to fold it. And then you get to the debate. Who does it? When do you do it? You don't have time. You have one mountains and mountains of laundry, and you don't know what to do with it. So I said, there must be another way to do it. And that's why we started working on FoldyMate. And now we're so excited that we're almost on the verge of making it happen.
We got this PR blast a few days back, and I was very interested in the simplicity of the device. I mean, it is an intricate design. It's fantastic in how well it works. But when you look at it, you go, yeah, that's how someone should have built the robot. Could you show me a couple of the steps? What would I do to my laundry in order for the FoldyMate to be able to fold it?
Sure. So it's very simple, and, that's what we wanted to do. You just take a dried item out of your laundry baskets or directly from your washer and or your dryer, I'm sorry. And you just clip it on like that here and you're done. Now, after you clip it on, it goes inside and you clip another one and another one. And within minutes, you get all of your laundry folded for you. Now, if that's not enough, that's the first time in the laundry industry that we're capable of treating your laundry on an individual item base. What do I mean by that? If we fold it for you, why don't we just do some de-wrinkling for you all the way? So not ironing. Ironing is 100%, de-wrinkling is 50%. But still, we can take a pair of jeans and make them more wearable after the laundry. Right? Now, if that's not enough, we said, okay, why don't we just give you some treatment options? So you take a specialized capsule in the scent that you love or in a softener and you apply it on the fabric while it's being folded. And that's the optional bonus features that we're including in Folimate. In the end, within a few minutes, you clip everything on and neatly folded stack on the bottom. And you could fold garments like shirts, pants, towels, pillowcases, anything that fits inside, apart from very large items like linen or very short items, small items like underwear. And
so basically, this is one of these kinds of machines where if you're a person who goes home and you take off your pants and you kind of throw it over the back of a chair, why not just clip it into the Folimate? It'll do a quick refresh and you're ready to go the next day.
Exactly. It's more than that. It goes out of the dryer usually, and instead of going into the basket, it goes into Folimate and into the closet, and that's it. And now my 9-year-old son is waiting to help out with the laundry. He's like calling me, Dad, can we have a Folimate at home already? Because he's dying to, you know, to use it. And think about it. Now it's not only me helping out or my wife. We extend the helpers in the helper circle in the family.
That's wonderful. Now, I know there's people in our audience who are thinking, okay, this is something I'd like, something that I could put in the corner of my room and keep my laundry looking good. But the big question always has to be pricing and availability. How much is a Folimate going to set them back, and when might they be able to get one?
You're right. And when I set out to do it, I wanted to do it for my family, but also for my friends and the people around me. So I wanted it to be affordable, like a high-end washer or dryer. And that's why we set our target price point, which is very challenging, between $700 to $850. Today, you can actually reserve units because we're still in prototyping stage. So customers go online, reserve a unit, pay a small deposit, and then they can receive 10% discount and shipping priority. And it will be available towards the end of this year. We will launch the pre-orders, and first units will ship a year later to those who reserved and pre-ordered their units. So late 2018, hopefully Christmas, we're making our best shot at it, you will have a Folimate at your home so you can focus on the holiday.
Gal, thank you very much for speaking with us. Thank you for sharing the Folimate. If they wanted to find out more about this machine, more about your company, more about why you created it, where should they go?
Folimate.com. All of the information there. The videos are there. And you can follow us on social media. We're very, very transparent and communicative of our progress and what's going on. That's why we came to CES at an early stage like that.
It's Folimate. Doesn't do windows, but it does do laundry. TVs and CES have long gone together, and over the years we've seen some great advancements. Everything from the first 720 TV, the first 1080 TV, then to 3D, to HDR and 4K, which is why I'm here at Samsung, because 4K content is finally here. Now, when we think of Samsung, we think of displays. You make beautiful, vibrant displays, but there is a specific piece of technology that has really, well, made Samsung TVs pop. Can you tell me what this quantum dot tech means?
That's right. At Samsung, we are all about innovation and continuing to bring consumers fresh and amazing ways to deliver the best-in-class experience when it comes to TV. And this year, we're introducing the QLED TV, which is based on the power of something called quantum dots. And what quantum dots do is they transform light into color. So what we're able to achieve with these incredible little pieces of technology is a 100% accuracy based on the color volume of DCI-P3, which is the widest color space that we're able to achieve in TV today.
And of course, if you can make color in the precise wavelength that you want, it means that you don't have to filter it. It also means that the colors more accurately match what the source material actually says they should be. But I've got to ask you, we've seen a divergence over the last year of the different manufacturers, and I don't want to name them, but some have gone with OLED, some have gone AMOLED, some have gone with LCD, saying, look, this is still the best proven technology, mostly because of yields. Why has Samsung gone with this quantum dot technology, and is it something that you expect to keep pushing out, perhaps increasing your yield over the next few years?
Well, I think we've seen a big growth within the quantum dot sector when it comes to TVs, and Samsung has been doing this for a couple years now and feel like we've really perfected the process of building quantum dots and making them so that they're able to provide picture quality in the manner that it's meant to be seen. So when it comes to picture quality, it's not just about one or two factors when we're thinking of things like color, brightness, contrast, black level, off-axis viewing angles. Those all create picture quality, and with quantum dots and the way way we're able to manufacture them, we're able to tell the story and deliver the best in class when it comes to all factors so that consumers can have the best possible experience no matter what they're watching. And they can also have it at affordable prices as well, and something that's durable and also energy efficient, which is what we get from Quantum Dot based televisions.
Now let's talk about that affordability, because affordability is usually about yields. If you can't get the panels in the size that you want and the quantity that you need, the price always goes up. Samsung seems to have found a sweet spot. You found that secret sauce that lets you keep the yields up and the prices down. Tell me, how big can you practically make a Quantum Dot screen before you're just failing too many panels?
I wish I had an exact answer for that, but what I can tell you is this year our Quantum Dot based televisions will be available from 55 inches up to 88. And I guess in theory the possibilities are limitless with how big it can actually go, but this year we will see them up to 88 inches.
All right, we got to talk a little bit about content, because one of the big stories of this CES is that there are manufacturers who are finally putting out devices that can supply 4K content at a reasonable price at a reasonable time frame. It used to be, well, you would have a hard drive shipped to you, or you'd have to do some sort of online download. There are a few manufacturers on the floor right now who are giving us players that can do true 4K. What does Samsung have in the pipeline for people who want to keep their screens full of their favorite content?
That's a great question. I mean, we've seen a humongous growth when it comes to 4K and even HDR content and what's available for consumers. It began with over-the-top streaming providers delivering it first, and then we've even seen some come in from broadcast providers like DirecTV. Last year, Samsung introduced at CES 2016 the first true 4K Blu-ray player that we had tremendous success with, and we saw a pretty big growth when it came to the library of content available from movie studios. This year, Samsung is adding two new 4K Blu-ray players to the lineup that consumers can also enjoy, so they can see these TVs in their best possible state when it comes to the overall picture quality factor.
Okay, I got to ask you something that you're going to have to pull out of that crystal ball, and you can just go out on a limb here, it's fine. It took a while for us to finally say, yes, a 4K TV is something that you need. Because it was always, it's beautiful, it's nice, it's a little pricey, and I don't really have anything to fill it. Now that you can get them at an affordable price, now that you can fill it with all the content that you want, what's next? There's already talk about, well, do we start pushing 8K, or do we start just working on the 4K screens that we have and making them better and better and better and equipping them with more features? What's the future for Samsung?
I got to find this crystal ball you're talking about, because I could really use it in my everyday life. But for right now, the focus is on continuing to grow the Quantum Dot based technology that we're seeing with our QLED TVs. Now, what's next for Samsung? Who's to say? But like I said at the beginning, we're all about innovation and making things better and providing consumers with more options. We are actually showing a next generation 8K version of a QLED TV here in the booth, both in 65 inches and over 80 inches as well. So we are showing some different versions of what may come next, but exactly what's going to happen, I think you can definitely expect to see a continued growth with our Quantum Dot technology and QLED TVs.
Well, fantastic. Thank you very much for sharing your tech and sharing your time. If you could please tell them where they can find out more about Samsung, more about Quantum Dot technology, and more about the beautiful screens that we see behind us, where should they go?
For any information about QLED TVs or the 2017 lineup in general, you can go to Samsung.com for all your needs.
There you have it. It's Quantum Dot technology, the very, very big picture with very, very small dots. When it comes to wireless speakers, there's been only one brand that I've trusted for the last 2 years, and that's Fugu. That's right. The speaker named after the funny little fish has been my go-to, not just wireless, but wired speaker because of its size, its portability, and, well, just the quality of the audio. That's why I'm standing next to Gary. He's the CEO of Fugu. He actually brought me in before the product was even released, and now he's got good news for all you Fugu fans out there. They've revamped the line, and you're going to love the new quality and price points. Gary, tell me, what has Fugu been doing over the last 12 months?
All right. Well, we've been working on building some really great products. First off, the main thing I'm going to talk about tonight is the Fugu Go. It's shipping now. You can get it at Sam's Club, and we'll take it to a bunch more places. It's about 80% louder than our previous generation at half the price, now at $99.99. And so some of the cool things you can do now, it's still, first off, waterproof, shockproof, mudproof, dustproof, IP67, 5 feet drops to concrete. It's just built to last. Now, this guy here, he's the only guy that I know of that took my speaker to the beach, buried it in the sand, gave it to his dog as a chew toy, threw it into the surf. Yeah, yeah. He He may be ordained, but he's got a little evil streak to him, too. All right.
I love the toughness, because you got to remember, the sand in San Francisco isn't just sand. It's fine iron particles. And that's why I knew it would be a true torture test. That kills most speakers. Fugu didn't even blink.
I know. So we really build things to last. We really focus on quality. So hopefully everybody sees that, as you have, and we'll keep going and doing some crazy things. So Fugu Go. First thing also, we do this mounting cord. So you can pull this off, mount it on the shower. You can mount it on a fence. Now the other thing you can do to it now, put it on a golf cart, on a stroller, dune buggy, ATV. Now at 80% louder, you can hear it anywhere outdoors. And it holds on like great. I took this on a dune buggy 2 weeks ago, 4 hours on a Razor. One speaker you could hear with helmets, and on the roll bar, worked great, all right? You can also pair two of them. So now you've got 80% louder times two. Killer, killer price points. You can do them in double and stereo mode. All right, 10-hour battery life. So there you go.
Now, you didn't just create a new mono speaker for the wireless system. Right. You've also taken the original, the one that I've loved so much. I'm going to call it the Fugu Classic, and you've made it bigger and you've made it louder. Yeah. If there was one drawback from the original speaker, it's that I love the quality, but sometimes in a big room, you know, you wanted a little more oomph. Right. So you've given me the oomph. Tell me about these.
Sure. We're going to continue to build speakers that go after different segments. So for these are now the Style S and the Tough S. They'll be coming out in springtime. The key things we did was we heard people say, I'm outdoors. I really, really want it loud. So these are about 80, 90% louder with a really great sound to them. And you can pair these as well. So you can still drive a truck over them, waterproof, dustproof, mudproof. You can, you know, throw it in the ocean if you really need to, as this guy does. And they're just going to last for you. So that's Fugu S. Series coming out in spring. We'll talk more about it here in just a few months.
Gary, I got to say, normally I try to throw a couple of questions to everyone I interview to bring out the negatives, but sure. As a person who's actually bought these, not just for myself, but for gifts, I love the Fugu line. I think you've done really well, and I think they're an engineer speaker. Thank you very much for your time.
Always great to
Thank
see you
for your tech. Tell them, where do they go if they want the best wireless speaker on the market?
Fugu.com, F-U-G-O-O.com, or the Go Anywhere Speaker Company. Take care, everybody.
There you have it. If you're looking for the best wireless speaker on the market, trust the one named after the poisonous fish. Wandering through the halls of CES, you find all sorts of people, including, well, my good friend. That's right. It's the home theater geek, Mr. Scott Wilkinson. Thank you very much for talking to us. Now, Scott, what have you seen here on the show floor that's got you interested?
Oh, quite a bit, actually. Sony, for example, has got a ton of cool stuff, one of which is called the Cletus. It's a video wall, basically. It's 32 feet wide by 8 feet tall. It's what's called a tiled display made out of what are called micro-LEDs. These LEDs are so tiny, they're literally microscopic. And it's got like, you can put a full white screen on there, get 1,000 nits, which is super bright. 4K, 8K, it doesn't matter. I mean, it just depends on how many tiles you put together. You can make any size screen you want. You could put it in a home theater, but it's really designed for things like designing cars and, you know, representing, well, what color do you want this car to be and so on and so forth. It reaches a much wider color range than just about any TV today. They've also introduced their first OLED TV, so that's very exciting.
Let me ask you about that, because we've seen a divergence of technologies. For the longest time, it was sort of, well, we'll move from this technology to this technology to this. And all the manufacturers were in lockstep, yeah. Because every successive step was better. And if you didn't offer that technology, well, you were obsolete.
You were behind the time, yeah.
We've now seen that's not the case. Some manufacturers, like Samsung, are doing the proprietary quantum dot. You've got other manufacturers who are staying with LCD, but with the micro-LEDs. You've got other manufacturers who are saying, no, we're going whole hog in OLED. Is there a winner here, or are we just going to see these develop on parallel lines?
Well, it's a little bit of a misnomer to say that, for example, Samsung has a proprietary quantum dot. They've licensed their quantum dot technology from a company called Nanosys, as have any of the other companies here that are showing what they're calling quantum dot TVs. Samsung is being a little disingenuous, in my opinion, by saying, oh, QLED is something new and special. It's not. It's basically the same thing we've seen before, as are all the other quantum dot TVs, which are basically just a different kind of backlight to an LCD TV. Sony isn't doing it really anymore. TCL is doing it. Hisense is doing it. There are quite a few people using this technology. I, in fact, just came from a meeting with Nanosys, the company that provides these quantum dots, and they were telling me about the next generation, which is going to replace the color filters. Normally you have white light coming through color filters on an LCD TV. They're going to replace those color filters with quantum dots themselves. Much higher efficiency, much wider color range. They say we should see actual products next year.
Well, at that point, doesn't quantum dot become OLED? It's essentially OLED.
That's an example of convergence. Exactly right. Now, quantum dots and OLED are not the same thing, but they are converging together. And one thing that most people don't realize is that OLED is actually just white light, a white OLED, going through color filters, just like LCD. And so this new technology of using the quantum dots as the color filter, actually what's called a color conversion from white to red or white to green or whatever, that can be applied to OLED as well. So
now, let's talk about filling the pipe, because we've got beautiful screens. Every manufacturer, even the smallest one, has a screen that we could all say is gorgeous.
Yeah.
Because that's where the technology is. Yeah. But the question has always been, well, what do I do with that? What do I fill that with? There's been ways to get decent 4K content, but I think I'm actually starting to see semi-standards-based, easy ways to get a movie in 4K, ultra Blu-ray over at Panasonic.
Right.
Is this actually happening, or are we just starting to see it?
Oh, no, it's actually happening. I met also with the Blu-ray Disc Association and the Ultra HD Association, both of whom are touting the disc format. There's now over 100 titles that they promised last year at this time that they'd have 100 titles by now. They do. They're promising 250 new ones in 2017. So the disc format is not dead, but there's also streaming. And streaming has its own problems. You know, most people in America, their download speeds are, 15 gigabits or megabits, rather. And to get a good 4K HDR stream, you need at least 25. So, you know, you're not going to get as good performance. My audience are all geeks. I mean, I'm the home theater geek, right? So they want the ultimate performance. That's going to be Ultra HD Blu-ray. And we're now seeing there are 7 companies that have Ultra HD Blu-ray players out. Now that they're out, they were introduced at less than half the price of Blu-ray when it first came out. So we're seeing a much faster adoption rate for Ultra HD TVs and for Ultra HD Blu-ray than we did 10 years ago when they first came out.
All right, Scott, I got to ask. A couple years back, the big story was 3D TVs. And then last year, it was HDR TVs.
Yeah.
What's the story this year? What's the narrative that you walk away from CES with?
Oh, HDR for sure. High dynamic range. 3D is dying. In fact, it's dead, I think. LG announced their new OLED TVs for this year. 3D is gone. Gone. And in fact, some of my readers on AVS Forum, when I posted that, said, I better get a 2016 while I can, because that's got 3D. Because, you know, we're geeks. We like this kind of thing. But for the general public, 3D in the home is pretty dead. In the commercial cinema, it's still very much alive. You see it a lot. But at home, Ultra HD Blu-ray doesn't even have 3D and it's part of its specification. So that's kind of dead. But HDR, high dynamic range, that's huge, and it's going to remain huge. It's not a gimmick like 3D. It's not something that you go, oh, yeah, well, maybe the glasses make me sick or whatever. HDR is really important, really cool. Many more TVs are having it now. That's going to be a big thing.
All right, Scott, thank you very much for spending your time. I know that you've got to get back to the floor because, by the way, folks, he's doing tomorrow's coverage. All home theater, all TVs, all audio, all the time. Where are they going to find that?
Oh, well, they're going to find it at twit.tv/HTG. We're not streaming live, I think, right?
We are, yeah.
Oh, we are?
Yeah.
Oh, well, then live.twit.tv. You want to tune in from 9 a.m. Pacific all the way to 3 or so Pacific time to catch that live. But otherwise, twit.tv/HTG.
Scott, thanks for your time. I'll be turning this microphone over to you tomorrow.
You bet.
And remember, if you want to see what's next for HTG, you got to trust the home theater geek. In the world of LED TVs, there's thin, and then there's LG thin. I'm standing here with James, who's going to talk about the W series of OLED TVs from LG. James, this is unbelievable. These aren't just TVs that are thin. I mean, they're basically just the film itself. Tell me about the W series.
Well, with the signature OLED, with the wallpaper, the benefit of it is the ultra-slim design. You're looking at 0.2 inches. So literally, you're looking at just the panel mounted to your wall, going down to a Dolby Atmos soundbar, giving you that premium sound to go with the premium picture. So let's talk about a little bit of the setup on it. You're looking at the panel literally mounts directly to the wall with a magnetic plate, snaps in with a slight flexibility, one ribbon cable going down to the box, and everything is in the components, and all the AV is built into that box. So whether it be processing, that's why it is so thin, because you don't need anything in the TV. It's literally just panel.
All right, let's do some of the specs that we got to get out of the way, because our audience is very tech savvy. They're going to want to know, what's the resolution? How bright is it? Does it support HDR? Give me everything you can about what this TV can do.
Absolutely. So we're looking at a 4K HDR TV, and we upped the ante a little bit this year. Last year, we went with Dolby Atmos. We went with HDR10. This year, we're going to be showing off some Technicolor HDR and some HLG in one of the other booths. That's going to give you all your four major HDR services. So you're getting that complex, pure contrast within that picture quality. Now, we added 25% bright luminosity to increase that brightness on it. So you're getting a higher contrast ratio with the TV and that HDR service.
Now, I do remember that OLED TVs tend to be ridiculously expensive. In fact, not too long ago, I saw a TV about half the size. Oh, by the way, what size is this?
This one you're seeing is a 65-inch.
Okay, 65. I saw a 32-inch panel probably two CESs ago that was going for $15,000. So I'm almost afraid to ask you how expensive this is. How much am I going to have to shell out for a W Series?
Well, it's subnational retailers today. It went on pre-order for $8,000.
Okay, not bad at all. All right, now I got to ask a difficult question, and that is, I love this kind of technology. I think it's beautiful. I think it's brilliant. I love the colors. I love the fact that it's OLED. I love the fact that it's so thin. But who is this for? I mean, who does LG envision is going to be the buyer of a wallpaper series of TVs that you have to mount on the wall? Who is your demographic?
Well, there's a lot of people that like to mount, and this gives you an all-in-one mount. I mean, you're literally taking it out of the box, being able to put it on your wall, and getting that pure, perfect, including an art gallery-style design. In fact, there's a mode in here just to give it that appearance so it can look like that beautiful picture that you want on your wall. So if you're looking for elegance, that's exactly what this is going to give you.
I love it. Now, for the folks at home, if they wanted to find out more about the wallpaper series of TVs from LG, if they want to find out more about your OLED technology, where should they go?
Absolutely go to LG.com. We can give you more information. They can give you more specs. Everything's going to be on there. And you're going to be able to see this stuff as it gets talked about at CES. So definitely check it out.
James, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your technology. And the future is really, really big and really, really thin. The big story at CES has been autonomous vehicles. How do we make driverless cars? How do we make them safe? But there is one company here who has taken one step further and said, well, what do we do once we have those safe autonomous vehicles? And that company is BMW. That's why I'm here with the director of product marketing, who's going to explain what they're trying to do to get you connected. Now, BMW, last year, they blew us away with their connected experience. This whole idea that you could have a vehicle that was connected to the cloud, that was connected to all your information. You've gone one step further this year, and BMW has gone outside of the car. Tell me about this.
So it's all about connecting your digital life and everything that you do in your normal daily life with the vehicle and all the other touch points that you have. So, for example, your smartphone, your smartwatch. We've integrated over the past year with Amazon Alexa, so when you're in your smart home and the things that you normally use there, you can also extend to the vehicle. The vehicle, certainly, and more touch points as you go forward. The mobility wall that you saw over there is another example of a touch point. So envision anywhere you use digital services as being accessible now to the data that you have in the cloud and, of course, perfectly tuned for the vehicle as well.
I love that BMW has captured this because it's a natural evolution of what we know. We know that we want our services everywhere, on our computer, on our phone, on our watch, and yes, on our car. And if it's going to be on our car, why shouldn't it be a similar experience all the way across? One of the things that you mentioned, though, was the integration with Amazon Alexa. This is a very hot topic, a very hot trend at CES. How does the connected experience utilize the Alexa API?
So at least today, what you'll see is our first generation integration allows you to check the status of the vehicle. So you can see how much fuel you have left, your battery charge level if you have an EV vehicle. You can lock the doors, unlock the doors, so a host of remote commands. You can ask Alexa what your next trip is, so you can prepare for that. So that's phase one as we add additional functionality to that. In 2017, you'll see more exciting use cases as well.
All right, if you told us phase one, maybe you can't tell us, but I got to ask about phase two. What happens when we start going beyond even that? When everything is connected, when I have this wonderful experience on every piece of glass that I have, when Alexa can talk to me in my house and inform me about my trip that I'm going to be making to the office, what comes after?
Well, you'll see that the intelligent personal assistant actually becomes readily available to you irrespective of your location. So, for example, this year we're showing integration with Cortana in the vehicle. Cortana is just one example of our vision for controlling everything you do via voice. So you can use your own personal preference, whatever intelligent personal assistant is important for you in your life that you use in your daily life, can be used inside the vehicle as well. But our example this year is using Cortana to be able to book a reservation while you have your feet off the gas pedal and you have your hands off the steering wheel. So you have plenty of time to do other use cases and have other experiences inside the car.
All right. I have to ask. We're going to this future, and we're rapidly approaching. I mean, I didn't think it was going to happen in my lifetime, but we will have self-driving cars, very safe self-driving cars. We will have all this extra time when we're traveling where we can be using the screens and our windows to call up all the information that we're connected to. So what's the BMW of 2030 look like? Is it going to be this luxury apartment that travels down the road, or do you have a vision for what a connected car that is still that ultimate driving machine might be?
So it's a combination of those. It's your mobile living room, for example. So when you look at the concept that we have here, this is all about making it as comfortable as possible for whatever your particular experience is. So on a shorter term level, in the 2021 time frame that we talked about, we showed an example in our Series 5 autonomous rides, and this time around, where we've integrated with Amazon Prime, for example. And so Amazon Prime, you can bring your own device, which in this case is a tablet, and if you're sitting in the back seat as a passenger, when you hit the play button on the video that you want to watch, your environment now changes. So, for example, the shutters go up on the side to reduce glare, the sunroof closes, the ambient lighting changes, the seat position can change. So all these things are part of creating your own personalized environment that's contextual for you, depending upon the experience that you desire inside the vehicle.
That's really making the car sort of an extension of your smart home.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Last question. Right. We know your strengths. We know what you do well. We know what you've created. What are the things that need to be solved? What are the bullet point items that need to be tackled before you'd be happy with where this connected project is?
Sure. Well, I think we need to solve some of the issues around automated driving. And there's plenty of those. Those are well known. But in terms of maximizing safety and making sure that everything's ready to go. So we're very pragmatic about that. And when we introduce automated driving, it will be fully vetted. The other thing is we're very sensitive to data privacy and security. And as you think about proliferating your digital life throughout all these various touch points, we want to make sure that as a trusted brand that we carry that security and privacy through all those touch points. So we're very sensitive to that, and we're ensuring that all those protections are in place.
Randy, thank you so very much for speaking with us. Thank you for sharing your tech. If they wanted to find out more about the BMW Connected Experience, more about any of the products or the technologies that your group has been working on, where should they go?
You can go to bmwgroup.com or any BMW site, and you'll see links there to Connected, and you'll get a sense for our vision vehicles. So,
it's BMW. It's not just autonomous. It's connected. Every year at CES, it's very easy to be overwhelmed by all the blinky things, by all the beautiful technology, by all of the things that look interesting, awesome, cool, that fascinate us, that sort of pull on that geek funny bone that we call our curiosity.
And yet when we get to the end of every show, the only question we have to ask ourselves is, how does this change what I know about technology? Now, many years we get to the end of CES, and the answer is, it doesn't really. Maybe the TVs are a little bit bigger. Maybe the computers are a little bit faster. Maybe I have a new mobile device that's slightly shinier or has slightly more features. But there's been all too many CESs that I've gone home and said, meh. Not so with this one. It didn't release anything new and earth-shattering, but what CES 2017 did do is it showed me that there are trends that converge all the different lines of technology that I have been following for years. Everything from Synology's new router to LG and Samsung's new TVs. Everything from the Alexa-connected security devices to the robots that actually live inside our homes have shown me that, yes, everything will be connected, and yes, very soon, everything will be part of my regular, average, everyday life. In other words, what this CES has done is taken something that I thought belonged to the Jetsons and given it to us in the Tesla generation. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit for TWiT TV, saying so long and goodbye from CES 2017.